Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. At washablesofas.com, you'll find the Anabe sofa, which combines ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. And get this, it's the only sofa that's fully machine washable from top to bottom, starting at only $699. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash, perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Right now, you can shop up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
He was the man who genuinely believed he could do no wrong. The ultimate narcissist. Or was he something more? Something much darker? Something we may not even have a word for. Today, the disturbing story of murder, lies, and the belief that one is invincible. The story of Ted Bundy. On the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Theodore Robert Bundy was an American serial killer who kidnapped, raped, and murdered numerous young women and girls during the 1970s and possibly earlier. After more than a decade of denials before his execution in 1989, he confessed to 30 homicides that he committed in 7 states between 1974 and 1978. The true number of victims is believed to be higher. Bundy was regarded as handsome and charismatic, traits that he exploited to win the trust of victims in society. He typically approaches victims in public places, feigning injury or disability or impersonating an authority figure before knocking them unconscious and taking them to secluded locations to rape and strangle them. He sometimes revisited his victims, grooming and performing sexual acts with the decomposing corpses until putrefaction and destruction by wild animals made any further interactions impossible. He decapitated at least 12 victims and kept some of the severed heads as mementos in his apartment. On a few occasions, he broke into dwellings at night and bludgeoned his victims as they slept. In 1975, Bundy was jailed for the first time when he was incarcerated in Utah for aggravated kidnapping and attempted criminal assault. He then became a suspect in a progressively longer list of unsolved homicides in several states, facing murder charges in Colorado. He engineered 2 dramatic escapes and committed further assaults in Florida, including 3 murders, before his ultimate recapture in 1978. For the Florida homicides, he received 3 death sentences and 2 trials. Bundy was executed in the electric chair at Florida State Prison in Rafford, Florida on January 24th, 1989. So today, the story, which you'd be surprised we hadn't gotten to yet, of Ted Bundy. It's going to be a multi-parter because there's just so much information with this insane individual. And we want to work our way through it and give it the time it deserves. If you like the show, be sure to press subscribe, whatever platform you listen to us on. We greatly appreciate that. A review on Apple Podcasts, also greatly appreciated as we grow in those rankings over in the true crime categories. Tony and Carol Hughes joining you on today's episode. Thoughts thus far and memories of good old Ted.
I don't quite know how to answer that. You know, I started, what is it, Netflix
yeah.
or something? I started watching a while back and I haven't finished it. But I had forgotten just how twisted it really was.
You talking about the Bundy tapes?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just finished it on Netflix. And then I thought, oh, we're going to do that for an episode today. The thing that was so crazy about Ted Bundy to me was his character, because he was so unlike any other serial killer or, you know, killer of high profile or trial of high profile in charisma and confidence and just how far he would push the envelope of what you would do in an acceptable way. I mean, he represented himself in court in third person. And watching that was just like, what the hell? I mean, I knew Ted Bundy was a horrible person and murdered people, but I didn't realize, you know, this was slightly before my time when he was in court and doing these things. But I was unaware that of all the antics that he did and all the times he escaped and all of that. But just when in front of the camera, just charismatic and the last person on earth, if you had to say who's the killer on here, if you muted it, he's the last person you would pick in almost every time, because it's like, this is not that profile of that individual at all.
And you know, he was a good looking guy. So good looking guys or girls, you know, you get a pass. It's like that.
And charismatic.
Serial murderer.
Even though he was a good-looking guy, if he had a personality that was just shit, you would. I mean, if he was like, nah, women, you know. But no, he was just so respectful, and the way he delivered his message, and it was. I mean, obviously the looks I'm sure helped him, but his charisma is what got me. Just going, God. So many ways he could have. I mean, the judge even at the end of one of the hearings was like, you know, I really wish I could hear from you more as an attorney, but you chose to go down this path and ruin your life this way. There's so many ways that you could have taken your God-given abilities and done the right thing, and you could have been an amazing attorney. And so
but
I don't.
Someone like you was never going to do the right thing.
That's the thing, you know. But had it been used for good, could have been very successful, could have been very. You know, but something was missing there. Something was missing for those connections in his brain to be that way. I have an interesting anecdote later I'll talk about that I learned in that story or in the Netflix documentary. Remind me about the apple pie later, okay?
Oh, okay.
And I'll know what I'm talking about, because it was an interesting one when we get into some of his family. Let's continue into the story of Ted Bundy here on the dark side of Wikipedia. Biographer Ann Rule, who had previously worked with Bundy, described him as a sadistic sociopath who took pleasure from another human's pain and the control he had over his victims to the point of death and even after. Bundy once called himself the most cold-hearted son of a bitch you'll ever meet. Attorney Polly Nelson, a member of his last defense team, wrote that Bundy was the very definition of heartless evil. Ted Bundy was born Theodore Robert Cowell on November 24th, 1946, to Eleanor Louise Cowell and Elizabeth Lund, or at the Elizabeth Lund home for unwed mothers in Burlington, Vermont. His father's identity has never been confirmed. His birth certificate is said to assign paternity to a salesman and Air Force veteran named Lloyd Marshall, though other accounts state his father is listed as unknown. Louise claims she had been seduced by an old money war veteran named Jack Worthington, and the Kings County Sheriff's Office has him listed as the father in their files. Some family members have expressed suspicions that Bundy might have been fathered by Louise's own violent, abusive father, Samuel Cowell, but no material evidence has ever been cited to support this. For the first 3 years of his life, Bundy lived in the Philadelphia home of his maternal grandparents, Samuel and Eleanor Cowell, who raised him as their son to avoid the social stigma that accompanied birth outside of wedlock. Family, friends, and even young Ted were told that his grandparents were his parents and that his mother was his older sister. He eventually discovered the truth, although he had varied recollections of the circumstances. He told a girlfriend that a cousin showed him a copy of his birth certificate after calling him a bastard, but he told biographers Stephen Michaud and Hugh Ainsworth that he found the certificate himself. Biographer and true crime writer Ann Rule, who knew Bundy personally, believed that he did not find out until 1969 when he located his original birth record in Vermont. Bundy expressed a lifelong resentment towards his mother for never talking to him about his real father and for leaving him to discover his true parentage for himself. In some interviews, Bundy spoke warmly of his grandparents and told Rule that he identified with, respected, and clung to his grandfather. In 1987, however, he and other family members told attorneys that Samuel Cowell was a tyrannical bully and a bigot who hated blacks, Italians, Catholics, and Jews, beat his wife and the family dog, and swung neighborhood cats by their tails. He once threw Louise's younger sister, Julia, down a flight of stairs for oversleeping. He sometimes spoke aloud to unseen presences and at least once flew into a violent rage when the question of Bundy's paternity was raised. Bundy described his grandmother as a timid and obedient woman who periodically underwent electroconvulsive therapy for depression and feared to leave their house towards the end of her life. Bundy occasionally exhibited disturbing behavior at an early age. Julia recalled awakening from a nap to find herself surrounded by knives from the kitchen and Bundy standing by the bed smiling. Bundy is a senior in high school. In 1950, Louise changed her surname from Cowell to Nelson, and at the urging of multiple family members, she left Philadelphia with her son to live with cousins Alan and Jane Scott in Tacoma, Washington. In 1959, Louise met Johnny Cupper Bundy, a hospital cook at an adult singles night at Tacoma's First Methodist Church. They married later that year, and Johnny Bundy formally adopted Ted. Johnny and Louise conceived 4 children of their own, and although Johnny tried to include his adoptive son in camping trips and other family activities, Ted remained distant. He later complained to his girlfriend that Johnny wasn't his real father, wasn't very bright, and didn't make much money. Bundy had different recollections of Tacoma when he spoke to his biographers. When he talked to Michaud and Ainsworth, he described how he roamed his neighborhood picking through trash barrels in search of pictures of naked women. When he spoke of Polly Nelson, he explained how he pursued detective magazines, crime novels, and true crime documentaries for stories that involved sexual violence, particularly when the stories were illustrated with pictures of dead or maimed bodies. In a letter to Rule, he asserted that he never, ever read fact detective magazines and shuddered at the thought that anyone would. In his conversation with Michaud, he described how he would consume large quantities of alcohol and canvass the community late at night in search of undraped windows where he would observe women undressing or whatever else he could see. Bundy also varied the accounts of his social life. He told Michaud and Ainsworth that he chose to be alone as an adolescent because he was unable to understand interpersonal relationships. He claimed that he had no natural sense of how to develop friendships. "I didn't know what made people want to be friends," he said. "I didn't know what underlay social interactions." Classmates from Woodrow Wilson High School told Rule, however, that Bundy was well-known and well-liked there, a medium-sized fish in a large pond. Downhill skiing was Bundy's only significant athletic avocation. He enthusiastically pursued the activity by using stolen equipment and forged lift tickets. During high school, he was arrested at least twice on suspicion of burglary and auto theft. When he reached age 18, the details of the incidents were expunged from his record, which is customary in Washington. After graduating from high school in 1965, Bundy attended the University of Puget Sound for 1 year before transferring to the University of Washington to study Chinese. In 1967, he became romantically involved with a UW classmate who is identified by several pseudonyms in Bundy biographies, most commonly Stephanie Brooks. In early 1968, he dropped out of college and worked at a series of minimum wage jobs. He also volunteered at the Seattle office of Nelson Rockefeller's presidential campaign and became Arthur Fletcher's driver and bodyguard during Fletcher's campaign for lieutenant governor of Washington State. In August, Bundy attended the 1968 Republican National Convention in Miami as a Rockefeller delegate. Shortly thereafter, Brooks ended their relationship and returned to her family home in California, frustrated by what she described as Bundy's immaturity and lack of ambition. Psychiatrist Dorothy Lewis would later pinpoint this crisis as probably the pivotal time in his development. Devastated by Brooks' rejection, Bundy traveled to Colorado and then further east, visiting relatives in Arkansas and Philadelphia and enrolling for one semester at Temple University. It was at this time in the early 1969, Rule believes, that Bundy visited the Office of Birth Records in Burlington and confirmed his true parentage. Bundy was back in Washington by the fall of 1969 when he met Elizabeth Koepfler, identified in Bundy literature as Megs Anders, Beth Archer, or Liz Kendall, a divorcee from Ogden, Utah, who worked as a secretary at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Their stormy relationship would continue well past his initial incarceration in Utah in 1976. In mid-1970, Bundy, now focused and goal-oriented, re-enrolled at UW, this time as a psychology major. He became an honor student and was well-regarded by his professors. In 1971, he took a job at Seattle's Suicide Hotline Crisis Center, where he met and worked alongside Ann Rule, a former Seattle police officer, an aspiring crime writer. She'd later write one of the definitive Bundy biographies, The Stranger Beside Me. Rule saw nothing disturbing in Bundy's personality at the time and described him as kind and empathetic. After graduating from UW in 1972, Bundy joined Governor Dale J. Evans' re-election campaign. Posing as a college student, he shadowed Evans' opponent, former Governor Albert Rossellini, and recorded his stump speeches for analysis by Evans' team. Evans appointed Bundy to the Seattle Crime Prevention Advisory Committee. After Evans was re-elected, Bundy was hired as an assistant to Ross Davis, chairman of the Washington State Republican Party. Davis thought well of Bundy and described him as a smart, aggressive, and believer in the system. In early 1973, despite mediocre LSAT scores, Bundy was accepted into the law school of UPS and the University of Utah on the strength of letters of recommendation from Evans, Davis, and several UW psychology professors. During a trip to California on Republican Party business in the summer of 1973, Bundy rekindled his relationship with Brooks. She marveled at his transformation into a serious, dedicated professional who was seemingly on the cusp of a legal and political career. He continued to date Koepfler as well. Neither woman was aware of the other's existence. In the fall of 1973, Bundy, at the UPS Law School, was there and continued courting Brooks, who flew to Seattle several times to stay with him. They discussed marriage at one point, and he introduced her to Davis as his fiancée. In January 1974, however, he abruptly broke off all contact. Her phone calls and letters went unreturned. Finally reaching him by phone a month later, Brooks demanded to know why Bundy had ultimately ended their relationship without explanation. In a flat, calm voice, he replied, "Stephanie, I have no idea what you mean," and hung up. She never heard from him again. He later explained, "I just wanted to prove to myself that I could have married her." Brooks concluded in retrospective that he had deliberately planned the entire courtship and rejection in advance as vengeance for the breakup she initiated in 1968. By then, Bundy had begun skipping classes at law school. By April, he had stopped attending entirely. These young women began to disappear in the Pacific Northwest. So, this is the mind of Ted Bundy thus far into the story. Thoughts on the fine young gentleman?
Because it's like, as you listen to it, there's so many points in there. A normal person had a zillion opportunities to grow in this world and be productive and successful and all that. And so as you listening to it, it's like, he seems pretty normal. And then it's like, oh yeah, I got back to her just so I could break up with her and get even.
Yeah.
You know, that's sick. Who does that?
Ted Bundy does.
Right? And then how would you feel if years later, then you find out, shit, I was dating him. I wanted to marry him.
How would you feel if you were the one on the other end of the suicide crisis line and Ted Bundy saved your life?
God.
That's bizarre.
I mean, that's bizarre.
It's the ultimate irony right there. It's like, if it weren't for Ted Bundy, I'd be dead. You know? It's like,
that's just
what?
Really weird.
That's the weirdest statement I've ever heard. But it's interesting. The whole thing, obviously you go back to his childhood. You got a question. Is he the product of incest? Could that explain the mental disorder that he suffered with? I don't know what it would be called, but essentially it's like you got a blank slate there when it comes to emotions. So the way he described it, where it was, okay, I didn't get these interpersonal relationships. I don't know why people feel things towards each other. But if I want to have any sort of normal interaction with human beings, or at least make them think I'm having a normal interaction with them, I have to learn how to act like them. So in some ways, the guy has a better understanding of how people tick and why they do the things they do, because he had to understand, he had to learn why A plus B equals C and how you get there. And what if A plus B, you know, minus D plus E, G and Q equals F? He had to learn how those equations work when all of us who just have the emotions, just boom, we get these emotions. And sometimes we know why we have them and sometimes we don't. But he had to figure out all these equations and why people tend to go to this way or that way in mass. So he, with having that understanding and that knowledge, that's how he was able to manipulate people. And that's why he had the charisma that he did, because he knew how to do it. So he made a perfect politician. Because he knew what to say and how to manipulate people in any way he wanted to without the repercussions of those nasty feelings that human beings get.
It's kind of like an alien.
Yes, it is kind of like an alien, you know, or the product of someone whose brain never developed correctly because he really shouldn't have ever been born, you know. But that's, you know, that's the scary thing. If you could take a look at his brain and try and figure that out. But I think psychologically, that's how he functioned, you know, because he knew all of it. I mean, that's how he was brilliant, but so lacking. And maybe that's what drove him to the murders. Maybe because he couldn't feel anything and everything was an equation that he had to work out in his mind of how to function, that the only time he could feel anything was when he did something so horrific as what he did, and that's what drove him to it. And it's not an excuse, but if you're trying to figure out a logic to how someone could get anything out of that, you know, it's a weird comparison, but as you get older, I just remember my great-grandmother when she was in a nursing home, couldn't taste hardly anything, but she could taste salt and she could taste honey. So she put salt.
She had COVID then.
Yeah. But she put salt and honey on almost everything because that's how she could get flavor. And you're old and she has heart problems and you shouldn't be consuming that much salt. But she would do it, and all that sugar. But because that's the only way she could feel that taste, and she loved flavor. So if your mind is missing those things and they're just gone, and that's the only way you can feel anything, I guess, you know, that's what leads to people when you have cutting. That's what leads to all those sorts of things. And I suppose, ultimately, if you go way down that track of, I'm so numb, I can't feel anything, that's what leads to someone like a Ted Bundy when you have that perfect storm of shit.
Well, and it goes, I think, even beyond... There's still something even more twisted in his brain.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I think that it was a power thing for him, too. Mm-hmm. I think he enjoyed being the guy who was good looking. I think he enjoyed like winning the girl back so he could dump her. Like, so there was just these sick things because he would get away with them because he could.
Yeah.
It was a power thing.
He's triggered in a couple ways. He's triggered by the murder because it's an extreme rush. And I think the power thing, the celebrity of it, the look at me, wow, what an amazing, that's an extreme rush right there. So he'd get those little jolts of feelings in those ways. And that's where I think he would go down those roads.
I mean, as sick as it sounds, and it doesn't even bother me to say this, but that's ultimately the ultimate for, you know, that's the power.
Yeah.
Is to take someone's life.
Yeah.
Look, and go about your business. Like, that did not bother you.
And that's what he did. And that's why he did what he did. And that's, I mean, it was a very interesting, you know, it's horrible what he did, but he taught us a lot when people look back on him in his case of the mind of a serial killer and kind of the playbooks that a lot of them go by in various shapes and forms. Let's get back into the story. The first two series of murders occurred in Washington and Oregon. There's no consensus on when or where Bundy began killing women, though. He told different stories to different people and refused to divulge the specifics of his earliest crimes, even as he confessed in graphic detail to dozens of later murders in the days preceding his execution. He told Nelson that he attempted his first kidnapping in 1969 in Ocean City, New Jersey, but did not kill anyone until sometime in 1971 in Seattle. He told psychologist Art Norman that he killed two women in Atlantic City in 1969 while visiting family in Philadelphia. He hinted but refused to elaborate to homicide detective Robert D. Kempel that he committed a murder in Seattle in 1972 and another murder in 1973 that involved a hitchhiker near Tumwater. Rule and Kempel both believed that he might have started killing as a teenager. Circumstantial evidence suggested that he may have abducted and killed 8-year-old Anne Marie Burr of Tacoma when he was 14 years old in 1961, an allegation that he repeatedly denied. His earliest documented homicides were committed in 1974 when he was 27 years old. By then, by his own admission, he had mastered the necessary skills in the era before DNA profiling to leave minimal, incriminating forensic evidence at crime scenes. Shortly after midnight on January 4, 1974, around the time that he terminated his relationship with Brooks, Bundy entered the basement apartment of 18-year-old Karen Sparks. Identified as Joni Lenz, Mary Adams and Terry Caldwell by various sources, a dancer and student at UW. After bludgeoning Sparks senseless with a metal rod from her bed frame, he sexually assaulted her with either the same rod or a metal speculum, causing extensive internal injuries. She remained unconscious for 10 days, but survived with permanent physical and mental disabilities. In the early morning hours of February 1st, Bundy broke into the basement room of Linda Ann Healy, a UW undergraduate who broadcast morning radio weather reports for skiers. He beat her unconscious, dressed her in blue jeans, a white blouse, and boots, and carried her away. During the first half of 1974, female college students disappeared at the rate of about one per month. On March 12th, Donna Gail Manson, a 19-year-old student at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, 60 miles southwest of Seattle, left her dormitory to attend a jazz concert on campus, but never arrived. On April 17th, Susan Elaine Rancourt disappeared while on her way to her dorm room after an evening's advisor meeting at Central Washington State College in Ellisburg, 110 miles east-southeast of Seattle. Two female Central Washington students later came forward to report encounters, one on the night of Rancourt's disappearance, the other 3 nights earlier, a man wearing an arm sling asking for help carrying a load of books to his tan-brown Volkswagen Beetle. On May 6th, Roberta Kathleen Parks left her dormitory in Oregon State University in Corvallis, 85 miles south of Portland, to have coffee with friends at the Memorial Union, but never arrived. Detectives from the King County and Seattle Police Departments grew increasingly concerned. There was no significant physical evidence that the missing woman had little in common apart from being young, attractive white college students with long hair parted in the middle. On June 1st, Brenda Carol Ball, 22, disappeared after leaving the Flame Tavern in Buren near Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. She was last seen in the parking lot talking to a brown-haired man with his arm in a sling. In the early hours of June 11th, UW student Georgemon Hawkins vanished while walking down a brightly lit alley between her boyfriend's dormitory residence and her sorority house. The next morning, three Seattle homicide detectives and a criminalist combed the entire alleyway on their hands and knees, finding nothing. After Hawkins' disappearance was publicized, witnesses came forward to report seeing a man that night who was in an alley behind the nearby dormitory. He was on crutches with a leg cast and was struggling to carry a briefcase. One woman recalled that the man asked her to help him carry the case to his car, a light brown Volkswagen Beetle. Bundy later told Keppel that he lured Hawkins to his car before rendering her unconscious with a crowbar he had earlier placed beside the vehicle. He then handcuffed Hawkins and drove her to Issaquah, where he strangled her. Before spending the entire night with her body prior to her murder, Hawkins had regained consciousness inside his car and began talking with Bundy, who recollected she had informed him she had a Spanish test the following day and she thought that I had taken her to help tutor her for her Spanish test, adding, "It's not funny, but it's odd and the thing kind of things people will say under those circumstances." He admitted to revisiting Hawkins' corpse on three occasions. He stated that he returned to her UW alley the morning after Hawkins' abduction and murder. There, in the very midst of the major crime scene investigation, he located and gathered Hawkins' earrings, one of her shoes, where he had left them in the adjoining parking lot and departed unobserved. During this period, Bundy was working in Olympia as an assistant director in Seattle Crime Prevention Advisory Commission, where he wrote a pamphlet for women on rape prevention. Later, he worked at the Department of Emergency Services, a state government agency involved in the search for missing women. At DES, he met and dated Carol Ann Boone, a twice-divorced mother of two who 6 years later would play an important role in the final phase of his life. Reports on the six missing women and Sparks' brutal beating appeared prominently in newspapers and on television throughout Washington and Oregon. Fear spreading among the population, hitchhiking by young women dropped sharply. Pressure mounted on law enforcement agencies, but the paucity of physical evidence severely hampered them. Police could not provide reporters with the little information that was available for fear of the compromising of the investigation. Further similarities between the victims were noted. The disappearances all took place at night, usually near ongoing construction work. Within a week of midterm or final exams, all the victims were wearing slacks or blue jeans, and at most crime scenes, there were sightings of a man wearing a cast or a sling and driving a brown or tan Volkswagen Beetle. The Pacific Northwest murders culminated on July 14th, when broad daylight abductions of two women from a crowded beach at Lake Sammamish State Park in Issaquah, a suburb 20 miles east of Seattle. Five female witnesses described an attractive young man wearing a white tennis outfit with his left arm in a sling, speaking with a light accent, perhaps Canadian or British, introducing himself as Ted. He asked their help in unloading a sailboat from his tan or bronze-colored Volkswagen Beetle. Four refused, one accompanied him as far as his car, saw that there was no sailboat, and fled. Three additional witnesses saw him approach Janice Ann Ott, 23, a probation caseworker at the King County Juvenile Court, with a sailboat story and watched her leave the beach in his company. But 4 hours later, Denise Marie Noslin, a 19-year-old woman who was studying to become a computer programmer, left a picnic to go to the restroom and never returned. Both told... Bundy told both Stephen and Michonne and Williams Hagmeiter that Ott was still alive when he returned with Nosland and that he forced one to watch as he murdered the other, but he later denied it in an interview with Lewis on the eve of his execution. King County police, finally armed with a detailed description of their suspect and his car, posted flyers throughout the Seattle area. A composite sketch was printed in regional newspapers and broadcast on local television stations. Elizabeth Kaufner, Ann Rule, a DES employee, and UW psychology professor all recognized the profile, the sketch, and the car and reported Bundy as a possible suspect. But detectives who were retrieving up to 200 tips per day thought it unlikely that a clean-cut law student with no adult criminal record could be the perpetrator. So, that's where we are thus far on the life and times of Ted Bundy. He looks once too clean.
I think because he was so handsome and charming.
Yeah.
That people trust that guy.
And he knew. If I look charming and handsome and I have this charisma and confidence about me, people are going to trust this guy. He knew how people worked, and that's how he got them so well.
It is so sick, and there's so many women.
And hey, if I go become the guy who is working in these departments of the government that are out to find people like me and prosecute and destroy people like me, I'm going to be a hero to women. Women are going to think I'm a wonderful person because I am out there fighting this fight when in reality, I'm the one who I'm writing the manual about who to catch. What I wonder about that though, if you were to look at his work on those manuals, did he like give like the profile of himself of like the type of person to look out for, or did he like deliberately skewer them in a different direction?
I was thinking that at the same time.
Kind of like a self-hate thing, you know? Or was it like, no, go this way? I don't know. Ted Bundy, not the nicest of folks. Let's do a little bit more as we continue into the story of Theodore Bundy today on the dark side of Wikipedia. On September 6, two grouse hunters stumbled across the skeletal remains of Ott and Nausland near a service road in Issaquah, 2 miles east of Lake Sammamish State Park. An extra femur and several vertebrae found at the site were later identified by Bundy as Gorgon Hawkins. 6 months later, forestry students from Green River Community College discovered the skulls and mandibles of Healy, Rancourt Parks, and Ball on Taylor Mountain, where Bundy frequently killed, just east of Issaquah. Manson's remains were never recovered. In August of 1974, Bundy received a second acceptance from the University of Utah Law School and moved to Salt Lake City, leaving Kopner in Seattle. While he called Kopner often, he dated at least a dozen other women. When he studied a first-year law curriculum a second time, he was devastated to find out that the other students had something, some intellectual capacity that he did not. He found the classes completely incomprehensible. "It was a great disappointment to me," he said. A new string of homicides began the following month, including two that would remain undiscovered until Bundy confessed to them shortly before his execution. On September 2nd, he raped and strangled a still unidentified hitchhiker in Idaho, then either disposed of the remains immediately in a nearby river or returned the next day to photograph and dismember the corpse. On October 2nd, he sees 16-year-old Nancy Wilcox in Holiday, a suburb of Salt Lake City. Her remains are buried near Capitol Reef National Park, some 200 miles south of Holiday, but were never found. On October 18th, Melissa Ann Smith, the 17-year-old daughter of the police chief in Midvale, another Salt Lake City suburb, disappeared after leaving a pizza parlor. Her nude body was found in a nearby mountainous area 9 days later. Postmortem examination indicated that she may have remained alive for up to 7 days following her disappearance. On October 31st, Laura Ann Emay, also 17, disappeared 25 miles south in Lehigh after leaving a cafe just after midnight. Her naked body was found by hikers, 9 miles to the northeast in American Fork Canyon on Thanksgiving Day. Both women had been beaten, raped, sodomized, and strangled with nylon stockings. Years later, Bundy described his post-mortem rituals with the corpses of Smith, Amy, including hair shampooing and application of makeup. In the late afternoon of November 8th, Bundy approached 18-year-old telephone operator Carol Durant at a Fashion Place Mall in Murray, less than a mile from Midvale Restaurant where Melissa Smith was last seen. He identified himself as Officer Roseland of the Murray Police Department and told DeRoss that someone had attempted to break into her car. He asked her to accompany him to the station to file a complaint. When Duranche pointed out to Bundy that he was driving on a road that did not lead to the police station, he immediately pulled to the shoulder and attempted to handcuff her. During their struggle, he inadvertently fastened both handcuffs to the same wrist, and Duranche was able to open the car door and escape. Later that evening, Deborah Jean Kent, a 17-year-old student at Viewmont High School in Bountiful, 20 miles north of Murray, disappeared after leaving a theater production at a school to pick up her brother. The school's drama teacher and the student told police that a stranger had asked each of them to come out of the parking lot to identify a car. Another student later saw the same man pacing in the rear of the auditorium, and the drama teacher spotted him again shortly before the end of the play. Outside the auditorium, investigators found a key that unlocked the handcuffs removed from Carol Duranche's wrist. In November, Elizabeth Kaufner called King County Police a second time after reading that young women were disappearing in towns surrounding Salt Lake City. Detective Randy Hershenmeyer of the Major Crimes Division interviewed her in detail. By then, Bundy had risen considerably on the King County hierarchy of suspicion, but the Lake Sammamish witness considered most reliable by detectives failed to identify him in a photo lineup. In December, Kloffner called the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office and repeated her suspicion. Bundy's name was added to their list of suspects, but at the time, no credible forensic evidence linked him to the Utah crimes. In January of 1975, Bundy returned to Seattle after his final exam and spent a week with Kloffner. I did not tell him that she had reported him to police on three occasions. She made plans to visit him in Salt Lake City in August. In 1975, Bundy shifted much of his criminal activity eastward from his base of Utah to Colorado. On January 12th, a 23-year-old registered nurse named Carolyn Eileen Campbell disappeared while walking down a well-lit hallway between the elevator and her room at the Willowwood Inn, now the Willowwood Lodge in Snowmass Village, 400 miles southeast of Salt Lake City. Her nude body was found a month later next to a dirt road just outside the resort. She had been killed by blows to her head from a blunt instrument that left distinctive line gear groove depressions on her skull. Her body also bore deep cuts from a sharp weapon. On March 15th, 100 miles northeast of Snowmass Vale, ski instructor Julie Cunningham, 26, disappeared while walking from her apartment to a dinner date with a friend. Bundy later told Colorado investigators that he approached Cunningham on crutches and asked her to help carry his ski boots to his car, where he clubbed and handcuffed her, then assaulted and strangled her at the secondary site near Rifle, 90 miles west of Vale. Weeks later, he made the six-hour drive from Salt Lake City to revisit her remains. Denise Lynn Olivierson, 25, disappeared near the Utah-Colorado border in Grand Junction on April 6 while riding her bicycle to her parents' house. Her bike and sandals were found under a viaduct near a railroad bridge. On May 6, Bundy lured 12-year-old Lynette Dawn Culver from Alameda Junior High School in Pocoleto, Idaho, 160 miles north of Salt Lake City. He drowned and then sexually assaulted her in his hotel room before disposing of her body in a river north of Pocoleto. In mid-May, three of Bundy's Washington State DES co-workers, including Carol Ann Boone, visited him in Salt Lake City and stayed a week in his apartment. Bundy subsequently spent a week in Seattle with Kloffner in early June, and they discussed getting married the following Christmas. Again, Kloffner made no mention of her multiple discussions with the King County Police and Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office. Bundy disclosed neither his ongoing relationship with Boone nor a concurrent romance with a Utah law student known in various accounts as Kim Andrews or Sharon Auer. On June 28th, Susan Curtis vanished from the campus at Brigham Young University in Provo, 45 miles south of Salt Lake City. Curtis's murder became Bundy's last confession tape recorded moment before entered into the execution chamber. The bodies of Wilcox, Kent, Cunningham, Oliverson, Culver, and Curtis were never recovered. In August or September of 1975, Bundy was baptized into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, although he was not an active participant in service and ignored most church restrictions. He would later be excommunicated by the LDS Church following his 1976 kidnapping conviction. When asked his religious preference after his arrest, Bundy answered Methodist, the religion of his childhood. In Washington State, investigators were still struggling to analyze the Pacific Northwest murder spree that had ended as abruptly as it had begun. In an effort to make sense of an overwhelming mass of data, they resorted to the then innovative strategy of compiling a database. They used a King County payroll computer, a huge primitive machine by contemporary standards, but the only one available for their use. After inputting the many lists that had been compiled, classmates and acquaintances of each victim, Volkswagen owners named Ted, known sex offenders, and so on, they curated the computer for coincidences. Out of thousands of names, 26 turned up on four lists. One was Ted Bundy. Detectives also manually compiled a list of their 100 best suspects, but Bundy was on that list as well. He was literally at the top of the pile of suspects when word came from Utah of his arrest. And they finally catch him, if they can.
And in that segment alone, I don't even know how many women and girls you mentioned.
I know. And you breeze over them because there's so many of them.
And those are all people, you know?
And families, yes. And parents, yeah. And brothers and sisters, and just
like
gone.
And that would be such a, you know, like how some people got a bad vibe from him and then didn't go with him or for whatever reason. And yep. Then to know somebody else fell for that.
Yeah.
And that person ended up dead and it could have been you.
Yep.
Golly. And there's just so much just sadness, you know, and like he doesn't even care.
No. He doesn't know how to care. Part is missing.
And anyone listening, we can't relate to that.
No. I other than just trying to understand the concept, but I couldn't tell you the feeling, you know, unless you're there, but
it must be some sort of power, like king-like thing. Like I can do whatever I want and I can take lives and in like entitlement and like there must be so, like, how do you give yourself permission to do that, you
and
know?
And so lonely and empty.
A person could never do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that was part of the problem where, you know, he also didn't do a great job in law school either because he was missing something. And as heartless as attorneys can be sometimes, giant part of that job is conveying emotion. I mean, that is the biggest part of the job. It is swaying someone emotionally one way or another. And I mean, he may have had enough to like ruse people for a while, but it's a whole different thing when you're an attorney in court and you're trying to sway someone emotionally.
Yeah.
So that's where I think he realized where his limitations were in terms of you know, faking it until you make it, although he could never make it, you know. But
man.
Just a dark story. And it doesn't stop there. We're roughly about halfway through the Ted Bundy story, which will continue in our next episode here with Carol on the Dark Side of Wikipedia as we dig deeper into the dark and disturbing world of Ted Bundy. If you like our program, be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Press share. Let people know we exist. Without your support, we would not. And we had a great 2020 getting the show off the ground. And this one is certainly sticking around as we go into the year of 2021 deeper and deeper. So please do. Help spread the word about the dark side of Wikipedia. Until next time, for Carol and all of us at the Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. At washablesofas.com, you'll find the Anabe sofa, which combines ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. And get this, it's the only sofa that's fully machine washable from top to bottom, starting at only $699. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Right now, you can shop up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N, Rakuten.com.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Workplace stress is now a leading cause of declining mental health, with 61% of the global workforce feeling it more than ever. You can't escape work, but you can take small steps to care for yourself. A walk, some sun, a favorite song. Therapy is one of those steps, ongoing support to build resilience for whatever your day throws at you. Balance is tough. Getting help shouldn't be. Visit BetterHelp.com today for 10% off your first month.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Tired of spills and stains on your sofa? WashableSofas.com has your back. Featuring the Anabe Collection, the only designer sofa that's machine washable inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slipcovers made with performance fabrics. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Check out WashableSofas.com and get up to 60% off your Anabe sofa, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time for a sofa upgrade? Visit washablesofas.com and discover Anabe, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices, with sofas starting at $699. Anabe brings you the ultimate in furniture innovation with a modular design that allows you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabe is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquid simply slides right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink-in feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit WashableSofas.com to upgrade your living space today with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get up to 60% off plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.